Thursday hits, and the fast is broken, and there's celebration. And then Good Friday, and for those of you who joined us for our community Good Friday service this past Friday, Friday is a dark day in the history of the church, because it is the day that our Savior is killed. Yesterday, I posted, if you follow us on Facebook, a graphic about Silent Saturday, which is often not mentioned. Silent Saturday is the day that we are just pausing before the big Easter celebration. But for those early disciples, it was over. And all of the promises they thought they could trust, all of the things they thought they could believe, they're just dumbfounded. They don't know what they're going to do. They're gathering together. They're questioning. They're afraid who's coming for them. Until this morning, as Scott and Donna read the two passages of Scripture about the resurrection and just the reintroduction to Jesus post-death is an amazing moment in which they realize this is the real thing. So as we come together and we celebrate Easter, we recognize and we remember that Jesus is alive. Jesus rose from the dead. Our faith is not based on just hope, but there is a basis for us to trust. And not only do we believe that, there were many who would see Jesus in those few days following his resurrection to the time in which he would ascend to heaven that continue to validate that story, but also 2,000 years of people following Jesus just reminds us that this is more than just an activity we do on Sundays. This is a way of life. This is a way of seeing the world. This is a view or a perspective of what God is trying to do around us, and we get to be a part of that. We're going to actually continue our study in Mark, which has some very interesting connections to the resurrection story. I want to make those connections. We're going to do another section where I want to just kind of walk through how do we read the Bible. And then I want to talk about what does all this mean for us. Following up where we've been, for those of you who haven't been with us for the last few weeks, Jesus is in the process of training his disciples. He's just sent them out on one of their most significant moments, which is to go out and two by two go into neighboring towns and minister and do the things that Jesus was doing. As Jimmy mentioned, our mission of being with Jesus, becoming like Jesus, and doing what Jesus did. We didn't make that up. Jesus demonstrated what it looks like to be his apprentice. So they go out two by two. They get the terrible news that John the Baptist has been killed. They try to get away, and in trying to get away to process and rest and recover and just figure out what does this mean for us, they're immediately swamped by people that saw them going, ran around the Sea of Galilee until they intercepted them. And then the disciples, now beginning to see the way Jesus saw, said, we've got to feed them. We did a lot of work with numbers over the last weekend, and we're going to revisit those numbers because Jesus fed the 5,000, or the disciples, really, Jesus presented the opportunity. The disciples fed the 5,000. We're going to come in just a couple of chapters where they feed the 4,000. And you may be thinking, well, I mean, I guess Jesus wasn't as popular for that event. But if you follow it along the numbering system that they would have understood, numbers have meanings. Now that story makes complete sense when you understand where that moment is happening. So they have fed the 5,000. They're getting away again. And Jesus does something interesting. He says, you all go to the other side. Let me dismiss the crowds. I'll catch up with you. Now, I don't know what was going on in their minds, but they're getting in a boat to go across the Sea of Galilee. How exactly is Jesus going to catch up with them? And how long would it take for him to catch up with them? We don't know. But that is the environment in which we enter into this story. But before we can go into this story, I want to read a passage from Exodus, and I want to introduce you to one of our fun theological words, because this story is about Jesus walking on water, but this story is also not about Jesus walking on water. So are you excited about that? Thoroughly confused? Great. Exodus 33, beginning with verse 17. And the Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. And Moses said, please show me your glory, or let me see you. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. I want you to lock that away, even just for a few minutes, even if it doesn't stay there forever. Lock that away. You cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Now, I want to introduce you to one of our churchy words that you're never going to use anywhere outside of church. I'm pretty confident, but yet it is an important word to understand about what this story is all about. The word is theophany. And theophany is described or is defined as a physical encounter with the physical manifestation of God. Now, I want you to think back through what you know of the Old and New Testaments to moments in which the physical presence of God seems to be in front of someone that is trying to see God. So we just read one about Moses. Can you think of any others? Elijah? Yes, the angel of the Lord and Joshua? The burning bush? Yes. The garden, one of maybe perhaps the best representation of walking and experiencing God in a physical way in the garden. I want you to lock away this idea of a theophany, the idea that you get to experience God in some way in a physical presence, a manifestation in a physical presence of God. Now that you lock those two things away, let's go into our story. I want us to point out some problems of the story, and our Bema folks know what I mean by problems. What are the things that don't make sense in this story? Because usually the things that don't make sense are the things that are pointing you to what the real meaning of the story is. Why is that there? This doesn't make any sense. This is not how I would have written this story. Those are the kinds of things that make you think, I need to dig deeper. So let's go to Mark chapter 5, beginning with verse 45. And as we enter into this story, if you've been with us through the series of Mark, you know we've already talked that water demonstrates or reflects this chaotic nothingness. The people of Israel are desert people. There are some fishermen in the ports, but for the most part, they're an agrarian group that stays in the desert, and water is dangerous. That is where people die. And as we look at the beginning in the story of Genesis, We are introduced into God's initial work of creation, that the Spirit is hovering over these chaotic waters. If you think, well, then that's it, we've already heard this story, stick around, because I think there's a lot more to this story than that. It says in verse 45, immediately, this is right after the feeding of the 5,000, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side to, where does it say they're going? You need to remember that. That's a clue. While he dismissed the crowd, and after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them. Now the fourth watch, if you break up the day into four periods, is going to be that part right at the beginning, right before dawn. If you'll remember, when we go back and look at creation story, in Jewish culture, a day begins the night before, not that morning. So what we do with our evenings sets what's going to happen for the rest of that following day. We tend to think, I'm going to get up and I'm going to start my day. Your day actually starts, in a Jewish mindset, actually starts the night before. So the fourth watch is right before dawn, right before sunset. And it says, he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them. I will give a hint, that seems interesting, like it's a race. I kind of picture them rowing against the wind and Jesus just walking by and say, I'm going to beat you there. I don't think that's what's happening, but this is kind of a weird part of this story, like he meant to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. But their hearts were hardened. What a fascinating story for us to talk about on Easter. But what a fascinating story, period. And one thing that jumps out at me is they have just fed 5,000 people with five loaves and two fish. And yet they were struggling to understand and their hearts were hard. We'll come back to that. The connection to the resurrection is interesting because there are some scholars that believe this moment didn't actually happen in this time frame of the Gospel of Mark. The Gospels are not necessarily written to be an order of events, but instead it is a story that is being told by the apostles. There are many that believe that this actually happened following the resurrection. I don't know if it did or not. But what's interesting is a connection to another post-resurrection event in which something very similar happens. We find that in Luke chapter 24. And it says, starting with verse 34, the Lord has risen indeed, but has appeared to Simon. Then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread, which would have been the Lord's Supper on Thursday night. As they were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, peace to you. But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. It's an interesting story in which both of these places, they experience Jesus in a tangible, unexpected way. And in the first one, he's called a ghost, which is the Greek word for phantasm. And in the second, it is the Greek word pneuma, which is spirit, which can also be translated ghost, but is not exactly the same understanding between what they saw on the water and then what they saw when Jesus just kind of appeared to them after the resurrection, but they hadn't seen him yet. Their response to both of these events was to be afraid. He must be a ghost. This must be the spirit of Jesus. He has died. How could he possibly be here among us? And I imagine in these moments of fear, they're just not sure how to process. What we know from psychologists is that when we don't understand something, it elicits a number of responses within us emotionally, psychologically, mentally. At first, we try to figure out how it works, and I don't know if you've experienced this recently, but with the advent of AI and advent of AI video production in which you're watching a video and it looks absolutely real and then it morphs into something weird and you're like, I'm trying to process this, but my mind can't process these competing images because that's not how the world works. When we do that, we have a tendency to feel some level of insecurity, uncertainty, and fear. And what happens repeatedly when the spiritual or the divine somehow interacts with people is our response is fear. We see that in both of these stories. I don't know if this story of him walking across water happened following the resurrection, but Mark is absolutely telling a story in a way, Luke is telling a story in a way to create connections for the people who are reading them. There's something connected here. And this story is just fascinating. I told you to remember a place where they were going. It says in verse 45, immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. To where? Do you remember? Bethsaida. If we go to the very next verse after this section, it says in verse 53, when they had crossed over, they came to the land at Gennesaret. But that's not where they were going. They were supposed to be going to Bethsaida. Now, I have a map for you to kind of see what happens here. And you can imagine there's a storm. I think I have a map. There it is. Where they're heading to Bethsaida, but somehow they end up all the way over here in Gennesaret, which is, we can understand, the storm pushed them in that direction. And so they didn't end up where they were trying to go to begin with. They didn't end up where they wanted to be. And then we have another interesting story of what happens when they show up somewhere they're not supposed to be. I don't know about you, but there are times in life I show up somewhere where I'm not supposed to be. Sometimes physically, sometimes I just look around at my life and I find this is not the place I was aiming for, but yet this is where I am. We find this over and over with Jesus. He ends up somewhere. Things don't go as planned. Just in the last 2 or 3 weeks of our series together, we've seen that Jesus is trying to get away. He's still trying to get away by himself, and it never works out that way. He gets crowded with people. And so they get across this Sea of Galilee, and it tells us, verse 53 again, when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. So we've been doing this how to read the Bible for a while now. Are there any verses in there that remind you of stories maybe we've recently talked about that make a connection here? Just a couple of weeks ago, there's a woman who has some issue of bleeding that won't stop. She's an outcast. She's unclean based on Jewish law for 10 years. No one's been around her. 12 years. No one's been around her. And yet there's this legend that emerges in the prophets that say there will be healing in the corners of the garment of the Messiah. And we understood that to be the kanaf, the prayer shawl that they would wear, the tassels that would hang from it. And they heard this story, and this woman was made well. Jesus was walking through a crowd. She'd been bleeding for 12 years. She touched this, just the edge of his garment, his tassels, and she was made well. And then Jesus stopped and he felt it. Something had happened and he turned to her. And that story was going throughout all of the area of the Sea of Galilee, so that when Jesus came to this place, if I can just touch the tassel, if I can just touch the tassel, if I can just touch the tassel, which I think is just an amazing way of doing evangelism, to be honest. I asked you a few weeks ago, I put you in groups around your tables, and I said, would you give a definition of what the good news of Jesus Christ is for you? And you couldn't use any of our churchy Christian language. It's when you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him. No. What is good about Jesus for you? And I think a good number of people that are very devoted to their faith would struggle to think about, why is this good news? So it's become popular within Christian circles, and we even at Easter, we talk about hell has no power. We just sang about that a few minutes ago. It's easy to lead with the gospel when it comes to something like hell. And I remember going through an evangelism course when I was a lot younger, and the very first question we would ask in this evangelism course was, and you could probably finish this question, if you were to die tonight, are you certain where you would end up for your eternal destiny, heaven or hell? Anyone ever had that shared with you? It's like when you go to a party and you don't realize that you're going to be eating food that you hate, and they put it in front of you and you realize, why did I even come here? The gospel is meant to be good news. So often, we try to enunciate the good with the bad. But just like this story, did you hear that woman? She'd been bleeding and she touched his tassel and she was healed. I want that. I'm going to try that. What if evangelism for us was just telling people why this was good news for me? Well, that sounds like good news for me too. I want that. Good news is so much more compelling than bad news, but bad news is motivating. Good news changes lives and changes hearts. What we know about Gennesaret is that this is an incredibly fertile place. It is the most fertile area around the Sea of Galilee. It is rich in moisture. The soil is rich in nutrients. It is a place where if you wanted to grow something, you didn't have to have a green thumb. I mean, it would grow. It was known as a place of prosperity. It was known as a place where you wanted to live. And if you were a farmer, like this is your ideal place, you know, location, location, location. This is your ideal place to be. But yet in this place that is remarkably similar in description to the Garden of Eden are a number of broken people that are in need of something. And Jesus stops, as he does everywhere, even when he's trying to get away, even when he's tired, even when he's just heard one of his best friends, his cousin, the one who was heralding him even before he was on the scene as a preacher or a rabbi, has been killed. He cannot get away. And yet in that moment when Jesus was just like, most of us would say, give me a break. Give me some room. I just need some time. If y'all just hang out over here, just give me a couple of days. I just need to deal with this. But instead, what we see with Jesus is he just immediately starts tending to the needs of the people around him, even when his own needs are not being met. This is a powerful image of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. That there are moments in which I just want my needs to be met. And we all know how that feels. And we've all had those in various places and various severities. And what Jesus shows us is, if you're my apprentice, if there are people in need, we're going to attend to them. And in this place that sounds remarkably like the Garden of Eden, we see Jesus putting a broken humanity back together again. This is what we celebrate at Easter. A broken humanity being put together again. So how do we read the Bible? How do we look for problems? I think there are three things that stand out to me as far as what are problems that I see in this story. And when I say problem, I don't mean like they got it wrong or it's not trustworthy or, this story is just told the wrong way. I mean, what are the things that just are a red flag that says something else is happening here and we need to stop and we need to explore a little more? I also want you to remember that these stories are often not Mark. The Gospel of Mark is written to a very Gentile audience, which is why we're going through it, because we are a very Gentile audience. But in general, the listeners and the hearers are already going to know a whole lot of the backstory. They're going to know the Old Testament. They're going to have learned the Old Testament. They're going to have heard it at the synagogue. They were going to be very familiar with these stories. And it was going to make connections for them, like the numbers we talked about last week, that unless we're putting that kind of work in knowing the Scriptures, we may not make those connections if somebody doesn't make them for us. So how to read the Bible, what are some problems? I think one of the first problems that stand out to me is, I've already mentioned it, he's walking past them. His intent is to walk past them. Now he sees that they're in trouble. He sees that they're struggling. They're afraid. I mean, did he think this through? Was it like, I am going to get them so good. I'm going to scare the bejesus out of them, literally. When I come, let's just wait. Let's just watch. It says at the end of that story that Jesus not only calms the disciples, but calms the storm, which kind of makes you think that maybe Jesus was whipping up the storm too. Could you imagine that kind of a friend? Some of you have those kinds of friends. You know, they set you up and then they sit back and watch for their plan to hatch. and then laugh whenever it finally comes to fruition. We sometimes read these stories, and I wonder if Jesus is thinking, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to get this storm going. I'm going to, like, we're going to make the wind go in the exact opposite direction of where they're trying to go. And then I'm just, watch this. Can you imagine if, like, John was there? I'm going to go walk out and watch their reaction. This is going to be awesome. I don't think that's what's happening here. But it is a fun way to read the story. And yet earlier today, I read you another story of how God reveals himself in a physical way to people. And in that story, it was the story of Moses. Now, what happens when Moses says, I want to see you? What does God say back to Moses? I'm testing your short-term memory here. Yes. Yeah, well, he said, I'm going to show myself to you, but first I'm going to have to put you in the cleft of a rock. You can see my back, but you can't see my face, because you can't see my face and live. When God shows himself in a physical theophany, in a representation, manifestation of himself to us, we cannot truly contain it. And so God put Moses, which was like their foundational story. Like we may on July 4th talk about the American Revolution, or there's any number of stories that you may think are kind of the foundational story of our story as a nation. But for them, it was the patriarchs first, and then Moses that really created an opportunity for them to be a nation, God's nation. And in this moment, God is going to pass by them. And as they read this story, while you and I would go, oh, that's interesting, that's curious. Why would he do that? He changes his mind and he goes back and he helps them, which is good. But why does Mark say he intended to pass by them? I think that's because this story is not about a boat or about water. This story is about the disciples experiencing the next evolution in their relationship with their mentor, their rabbi, the one who is apprenticing them. He's saying, I am God. This is so crucial at Easter. That Jesus isn't just a teacher. He isn't just a rabbi. He isn't just a guy that within an inch of his life, he ended up in a tomb and somehow was just didn't actually die and kind of hobbled out of the tomb and they nursed him back to life. Like, this is a crucial part of Jesus' message. This, I am God who has come here to be with you. And this is not God who has come here to judge you. This is God who has said, I am to be with you. Because just as the video we watched earlier says, resurrection is all about living. It's really not about dying. It's about living. Resurrection is about life. In that story of Moses, it says, this thing, very thing that you have spoken, I will do, for you have found favor in my sight. In verse 20, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by. Same idea. As you begin to learn and spend time in God's Word, you'll begin to make these connections. These stories are interconnected. They're trying to tell us something. A second thing, problem I found in this story, I think, is where Jesus finally walks over to the boat, and it's easy to overlook, but they don't recognize him. They've just been with him a few hours before. They don't recognize him, and Jesus has to say, it is I. It is I. Like, if I walk out of this room and then come back a few minutes later, and you're like, who are you? I'm going to think we need to get you some help, right? Do you need some new glasses? We need to get you checked. We need to get you tested. It is I. And yet there's another foundational story that this story is going back towards, also found in Exodus, in which God first reveals himself to Moses. This is how that story goes. Verse 13 in chapter 3 of Exodus. Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Or paraphrased, it is I. See, these connections that are being made, these disciples have been out learning, they've been practicing, which any teacher will tell you, and if you're trying to learn something, until you practice it, you haven't fully learned it. There are connections made within you, in your mind, whenever you practice what you've learned, that solidifies it, that makes it stick in there and stay. You've got to go practice it. That's why some of us who have recurring dreams in college, and I'll assume I'm the only one, and it's the end of the semester, and it's time for the final, and you've not been to class all semester. I don't know if anyone else has had those. People don't admit when they have them, because usually there's a little negative truth in all of those bad dreams. Like, you skipped a lot of classes, and you're just not sure what the answer is. You're just not sure that you're going to make it. Whenever we begin to practice it, we can't just study for a moment and it stick and it change us and it change the way we see. It takes practicing it. That's why we talk about doing what Jesus did. We can read about Jesus doing things, but until we put it into practice, it's all just theoretical. It's not something that is changing us. The story is God revealing Himself to those who would lead His people. This story is a theophany. He revealed Himself to Moses, who would lead them to be a nation. Interesting other connections. Between the time that Joseph comes to Egypt and Moses arrives on the scene is about 400 years. And the reason that God, or Moses, is introducing God to the people is because they've forgotten that in their lineage is Abram and Abraham. They've forgotten the history of following Him and of coming into Egypt. They've forgotten all that, and He's reminding them. And then, interestingly, in your text, between the last book of the Old Testament and Jesus coming on the scene is about a 400-year span. Israel does not hear from God for 400 years following Malachi. And then Jesus comes on the scene, this new Moses, to lead them to this new life. The reality at Easter is a whole lot of people will celebrate Easter but never experience this new life and this new way of seeing. Because worship services don't lead us to that. It is diving in a relationship with Christ that does. Diving into His Word so that we want to know it. And more so than just know it, live it out. The story is God revealing Himself. This is a theophany. And then the last problem I see in this story is, after they've just done something amazing, after they've just witnessed the impossible, it says that the disciples' hearts were hardened. Now, a whole lot of these visuals are hearkening back to the story of Moses, and this is another one. Can you think of another person who it is said that his heart was hardened? Y'all are already there. Isn't it fascinating when we start making these connections and we realize this book is so interconnected, that this Bible is not just a collection of interesting stories or ways to live life, but it is a dynamic, living text that draws us in. And when we allow it to fully pull us in, all of a sudden we discover the story that God is telling is so overwhelming, it's incredible. Just like Pharaoh, their hearts are hardened, and they have just experienced a miracle in the feeding of the 5,000, which we know is not just about eating, but is also about teaching, as we looked at that story last week. These connections, these disciples, they just don't know how to put this stuff together. My guess is that there are going to be moments within your life in which God is going to do something and you're not going to know what to do with it. And it's going to lead to a moment of fear, lead to misunderstanding, and may even lead to a hardened heart. Because these are so outside the way that we naturally, normally embrace life and each other, that we sometimes can miss it. This is a story about Jesus saying, I am God to the disciples. And their response to seeing him as such was to say, it's a ghost. I just wonder on that road following the crucifixion of Jesus, if those disciples hadn't really said in the back of my minds, I wasn't really sure if he was the real thing or not. I mean, even John the Baptist, one of the last questions we hear from John the Baptist is to ask Jesus, like, are you the real thing? My guess is everyone in this room at some point has wondered that same thing. Are you real? Are you the real stuff? Is this really trustworthy? And I bet in the back of their minds, they're thinking, it was a good run. I guess we missed it. Maybe we can salvage this somehow, or maybe there's another. Maybe Peter is going to pick up this cross now, and we're going to follow him. But when Jesus appears, they're afraid. It's a spirit. It can't be him. And it is. It is him. It's a story not just about having a hard heart. This is a story about hard hearts being softened. Here's what I want to wrap up with. There's a million takeaway points from this story. I want to list a few of them. You may have your own. The story says that when they got in the boat and they were rowing, that the wind was blowing against them. Do you ever feel like the wind is blowing against you? And you're putting everything you can into it. And maybe it's not physical. Maybe there's a relationship you're trying to heal, and you're putting everything you can into it, and you just feel like everything is against you. Or maybe you had this idea about what you were going to do for your career, and you started just working the plan, and you just felt like everything, including God, is working against you. What if God is closer than you think in those moments? When you're tempted to think, well, maybe God's abandoned me. What if he's closer than you think? What if through your turmoil, he's just walking next to you and you don't yet see him? Here's one of the great lies about the modern church is that we have a tendency to say that if you follow Jesus, bad things won't happen to you. And then people have bad things happen to them, and so they give up on Jesus because I follow Jesus, bad things weren't supposed to happen. And yet the only way you can come to that conclusion is to completely ignore the entire New Testament. Bad things happen in life. And when bad things happen, it's normal for us to go, God, where are you? Why aren't you rescuing me? Perhaps God's not just trying to keep us from experiencing bad things. Maybe God's trying to show us how to be resilient in the midst of bad things, because this is the experience of humanity and has been since Genesis 3. Do you find yourself in the story feeling like wind is blowing against you? Wondering where God is and why he's allowing this? Wondering if he's left you? And yet if we go back to Genesis 3, we find that when Adam and Eve had sinned, one of the first things God asked them was, where are you? Because his desire was to be with him. What if he's still saying that? I think this story of Bethsaida versus Gennesaret is all too familiar in my life. The idea that I'm heading somewhere and I open my eyes and I'm somewhere else. Maybe this is in marriage, right? You had the perfect idea of marriage and then you got married and you realized, you know, this person must have done a whole lot of work when we weren't together, because now that we're together all the time, I don't know that I can stand them. I know you all never went through that thought, but there are people who think that happens. This is not where I thought we were going to go. Or maybe you did launch on a career and you did have a clear plan of where you were going to end up and you were going to retire early. And all of a sudden, you're not in Bethsaida. You're in Gennesaret. You're like, how did we get here? How did we get here? Or maybe it's raising kids and, You know what? There's no better person who knows how to raise kids than someone who doesn't have one. All the parents are laughing because you know, because someone with no kids comes up and you've been agonizing over how do I deal with this, address this, move past this, lead through this. And then someone with no experience whatsoever raising kids says, well, this is what I would do. And you're like, yeah, it's so simple, isn't it? And then you say bad things and you walk away, right? But in our minds, we all thought, I'm heading to Bethsaida. I know what I'm going to do. But we ended up in Gennesaret. Did I do something wrong? I mean, this is life. Life is all about heading in a direction and ending up somewhere else. So what do we do in those moments? I think one of the things that Jesus shows us is time and time again, his plan is skewed. And you think, well, if anybody ought to have the plan work out the way that they want it to work out, it ought to be Jesus. But yet we've now seen for the last two chapters, Jesus is trying to get away, trying to get his disciples away, trying for some solitude, for some quiet, time to pray, time to process. And it still hasn't happened other than that short moment after the feeding of the 5,000 where Jesus goes up on the mountain to pray. He finally gets a moment. But everywhere he goes, the plan changes because crowds see him and just crowd around him. And instead of getting away to recover, they're just still being overwhelmed. I think one of the messages here is that we as followers of Jesus keep moving when things don't go as planned. We keep going. This is what it means to follow Jesus. God is with us. Had a conversation. A gentleman came to our Good Friday service on Friday. He was having a hard time. Felt like he had no opportunities ahead of him. Felt like he had made too many mistakes in his past. And I said to him what I say to you right now. There are times in our life that we cannot take back what has been, but we can ask now what is the right step right now. Take the right next step. And stop letting the past control your life. What is the right step right now? Take that step. I think another one, this is what I want to end with. As you begin to study about God, as you begin to read the scriptures, as you begin to really dive in and understand the message and the story that's being told from Genesis to Revelation, there's a whole lot of people that find out God is not who they wanted him to be. And they don't recognize him. Similar to the disciples on the boat wondering, is this a ghost? Where Jesus has to say who he is. We don't get a God in our image. That's not a God worth following. But so many times we want a God who likes what we like and doesn't like what we don't like. We want a God who wants us to have all the things that we want to have or wants us to do all the things that we want to do. In other words, we want a God who just answers all of our questions and gives us all of our dreams, and we don't have to change at all. And yet this is a God who's saying, put you back together, put humanity back together. Something's got to change. Discipleship isn't just saying a prayer or coming to church. Or making sure you don't say any bad words in public. It's about becoming an apprentice of Jesus, of who he is. Not who we want him to be, but who he is. The story is their history. It's their story. I mean, there are connection points in this story to Elijah, to Moses, to the parting of the Red Sea, to the creation story. There's connections of this story all throughout the Old Testament. But this is their history. And in this moment, what we celebrate at Easter is that this is what they hoped for, a true Messiah, the real thing, God in the flesh. And this resurrection life that we celebrate, if we choose to see it, it is life when we choose to live it out. This Easter is about life. As we follow him, as our rabbi and as our leader, as our trainer, may we see him as he was meant to be seen, to be with him, become like him and do what he did. We're going to take communion together. And if this is your first time taking communion with us, a couple of our elders will be up front. We'll break the bread, which is symbolic of the breaking of Jesus' body, and we'll dip it in the juice, which is symbolic of the blood of Jesus as it was spilt at his crucifixion. It is such a special time to take it, because this is the time we take it in remembrance, not that he died, but in remembrance that he lived. And we have the opportunity to do that too. What, Latisse?